Welcome to Central Coast Voices, a program addressing the ramifications of change in our communities and beyond, and how today's choices will impact tomorrow's community. This program is a project of KCBX and its team of program hosts. Today, your host, Chris Kington Barker, and her guest, Thalia DeWolf, RN, Nursing Education and Hospice Outreach Coordinator for the Academy of Aid and Dying Medicine, and author, will discuss the topic and recent surveys and information that has come to light here in California. As we are recorded today, we can't take your phone calls today, but we do encourage you to send any follow-up questions that you might have from our conversation today to voices@kcbx.org. With that, let's join Chris Kington Barker and her guest. Over to you, Chris.
Thank you, Brad. The End of Life Option Act was enacted in California in 2016, giving terminally ill adults the option to request aid in dying medication. Over the past decade, California clinicians have gained substantial experience providing this care, leading to stronger data collection, the development of best practices, and improved education for clinicians, patients, and members of the patient circle of care. But there's still so much that is misunderstood about the topic. My guest today is a certified palliative care and hospice nurse with a long career in nursing, who has also been involved in the clinical side of aid in dying medicine since it was legalized in California. My guest is Thalia DeWolf, RN, CHPN, Nursing Education Hospice Outreach Coordinator for the Academy of Aid in Dying Medicine. And Thalia, it's really good to have you here today.
Hi, Chris. It's a delight to be here.
You know, this has been 10 years now, and as I mentioned in the intro, so much is really misunderstood about aid in dying medicine. And I think maybe the first thing to start with is just that, the kinds of things that are myths that people believe, the kind of misunderstandings about who can access it, how they can access it. Maybe we can take a little bit of that and break it down.
Sure. I mean, we'll go back a little bit. And, you know, I have to say, early in my career as a hospice nurse, when this first passed, I think a lot of people really just focused on the prescription, like, oh, this was just a prescription and you just take it when you're ready.
Right.
And what we found out over time is that it's really not. Though the prescription plays a crucial role, it's really the continuum of care. When a patient is requesting medical aid in dying or asking about it, it just opens the conversation. It's part of end-of-life discussion. And patients aren't really decided about medical aid in dying until they actually ingest the medications. And many, many patients don't go all the way that far down. So that's like the very crux of most of the myths around medical aid in dying are that it's just a prescription.
Right. And so let's talk a little bit about what you're talking about. So when you're talking about the care and the aid, and it's the continuum of care. Someone has to be diagnosed with a terminal illness. So if I'm told I have a terminal illness, I'm going to trust my clinicians to give me care about treating my illness or maybe giving me more time, right? Or trying to get rid of that, which is terminal. But when somebody says your illness is terminal, they're saying the likelihood is that this is not survivable.
The legal criteria for medical aid in dying are important. They're not the end of the conversation, but they're beginning. You have to be over 18. You have to live in California, though some patients do travel to California to stay with family, for instance, or can establish residency without, you know, a huge effort. You have to have a terminal illness with a less than 6-month prognosis if the disease were to take its natural course. So one of the things that's crucial is that patients can decline further care. They can decline chemo. They can decline hemodialysis. You know, that's an option that for patients. And two doctors have to confirm that you've got a terminal illness with a less than 6 month prognosis if the disease were to take its natural course. And you have to have capacity to make your own medical decisions, which kind of means you have to understand what's happening in your body. You have to be able to explain it to your provider. You have to be able to know, you know, verbalize or communicate that you understand what your options are. You could continue, you could have hospice care, you could have continued care, but you're choosing to become eligible for medical aid in dying. And I'm gonna use that term a lot. Eligible for medical aid in dying does not mean you're done with the process. And then you also have to be able to self-ingest the medications, which means either swallow them or you can use a feeding tube, or some patients use a very small rectal catheter. They depress a plunger on a small syringe. The medications are 2 ounces, so it's not a large volume. But like, that's a lot of requirement. And you have to have two medical doctors confirm those criteria.
So I want to go back and break that down. You said that with running its natural course, it's estimated that a person would have 6 months to live. People are not, they don't have to choose the treatments that are out there for them. If someone is told you can have chemotherapy, and with chemotherapy and radiation therapy and other things that have been tried, we think that we can give you some more time, or it could do something. Someone could choose on their own body to say, I don't want that. Yes. I don't want that. That's not a choice for me. And look at other options and say, and I don't like the kind of cancer or the kind of illness I have and what I know the course of illness is, to ride that all the way to the end.
I think the piece of the puzzle, so I'm a palliative care nurse and I work in the emergency room and inpatient hospital. And what I think is important in what you're saying here is that people are deciding between a number of possible treatments. But what they're really choosing when they have what's called a serious or life-limiting disease is, at what point does the quality of life, you know, the burden on that, make the treatments something that the patient might not want? And no one can really answer that question but the patient themselves. Right. And usually patients do come in what I call constellations. So we come in connected with loved ones and family members and friends, and there's a lot of influence there. This is where palliative care ideally excels. Palliative care really, it's about helping patients with symptoms, but it's also really about explaining all the treatments, all the options, kind of slowing everything down and allowing patients the time to consider. And in healthcare, everything's in such a rush. Right. That palliative care is maybe one of the last refuges that lets things really slow down. And I really recommend that any patient that's considering medical aid in dying or considering their end of life options, including things like voluntary cessation of eating and drinking, hospice care, stopping chemo, continuing chemo. I mean, we have a lot of new treatments for cancer that are extending patients' lives and making cancer kind of a chronic condition. Some of those treatments are very acceptable, some of them are not. So navigating that terrain really takes expertise. Like, you can't ask me about plumbing. I don't know anything about plumbing. I would rely on a plumber to really give me sound advice about if I should replace my line out to my sewer. And I think, you know, when we talk about palliative care, it's not just doctors, it's nurses, it's social workers, it's chaplains, it's a team of people. Palliative care is not hospice light. It's really anyone with a serious illness or with advanced age can ask for a palliative care consult in most healthcare systems and, you know, receive a little bit of more information on their, ideally, you know, meeting their communication needs. So I think that's a crucial piece of the puzzle. Patients can decide, they can have autonomy, but they need to have the information first to understand what their choices are.
If a patient comes to a physician or decides, I choose medical aid in dying, that patient then needs to understand all of their choices, right? Because it can't be assumed that they've had all that information. Is it up to the physician? Is it up to someone to make sure that they're informed?
In the law, is a requirement that the physician who is evaluating the patient for eligibility for medical aid in dying, a crucial step of that process is that they provide counseling about all the options, including hospice care, including continuing treatment. All of that has to get fully discussed. And it honestly gets discussed repeatedly. So while it's a requirement for the what's called the attending, what I call the attending prescribing physician for medical aid in dying to provide that counseling, ideally also the patient and the family, loved ones, the circle of care, have gotten some of that information from nurses and social workers and have had the time to kind of consider it. The first step to become eligible for medical aid in dying is the first verbal request, meeting with a doctor who is willing and allowed by their system to act as the attending prescriber. So here's the crucial piece about that, surprisingly hard to find. The access issue of locating physicians that are willing and allowed to act as attending prescribers, it is not easy.
No, I know that in the Central Coast community, it's not easy because so many physicians are affiliated with religious affiliate hospitals or hospital systems. So they cannot give education and be involved in the prescribing.
I would back up and say they probably can give education, they can give information, but they can't write the prescription. So right. I think what happens for a lot of patients is they hear from their physicians or they hear from their team, oh, you know, we're supportive, we won't stand in your way, but that doesn't translate into an actual attending prescriber. So that can be very hard. And we see these numbers downstream. The public health department collects data about medical aid in dying. And what we see is the majority of patients are white, college educated, et cetera. Well, those are the patients that have been able to find access to medical aid in dying. It doesn't mean that we know how many other patients might be interested in medical aid in dying, but never had access. And we also know that in California, less than 25% of older Californians even know that medical aid in dying is legal in the state. I've had doctors come into my palliative care cubicle not knowing that medical aid in dying is legal, saying things like, oh my gosh, my patient is in so much pain and he's asking for euthanasia, which isn't even legal. It's only legal in Oregon and Washington. So, you know, the information, let alone, you know, being able to access it monetarily, the information about medical aid in dying is not widely available.
I'm Chris Kingdom Barker with you for Central Coast Voices on KCBX, your Central Coast listener-supported radio station. My guest today is Thalia DeWolf, RN, CHPN, Nursing Education and Hospice Outreach Coordinator for the Academy of Aid in Dying Medicine. She's here to talk about the End of Life Option Act that was enacted in California 10 years ago, giving terminally ill adults the option to request aid in dying medication. Our discussion today will clarify some of the myths about what aid in dying medicine is and who can access it, and talk about advances in clinical knowledge and best practices. This is pre-recorded, and we won't be taking phone calls. At the end of this show, however, we will be giving you some website information where you can go for more information. And Thalia, one thing that I'm curious about, when a patient is talking with a physician, How does the physician make sure that it's the patient's choice to use medical aid in dying, that they're not getting a lot of influence from the outside?
So that is another crucial piece of the puzzle. The attending prescribing physician who takes the first verbal request, once they've been located and the patient is in that room and having that conversation, there's a whole checklist of things that the doctor has to go through. One is to evaluate coercion. And usually it's, I mean, much like evaluating capacity, doctors are really trained. They know how to do this. And as a nurse, I can kind of do it, but luckily it's not in my wheelhouse. It's in their wheelhouse. They're evaluating the medical records to be sure that the patient has a terminal condition and a less than 6 month prognosis. And they're also evaluating, has anybody else, you know, put you up to this? Is anything else going on that their secondary gain, meaning the family's, you know, there's, it's complicated, but I think they often will shoo the family out of the room and ask a few pointed questions to assess for coercion. And then they go on from there and do continued counseling. So one of the things that I think is crucial for patients to know is in that evaluation, in those criteria, suffering is not required. It's kind of a strange thing to say, because in other countries, suffering is required for medical aid in dying. But in the United States, it's a less than 6 month prognosis, capacity, ability to self-ingest. Suffering is not something that the patient has to prove to the doctor. And that's kind of crucial. Not that it's not part of the conversation, it is still part of the conversation. Tell me more about why you might want medical aid in dying. What else is happening? Are you having pain? Are you having shortness of breath? Because actually, we're pretty good at controlling pain and shortness of breath. But there are certain kinds of suffering that we will attempt to, you know, control. And sometimes that's not solvable. It's not the only reason that patients progress and complete medical aid in dying. Often, and I've been bedside with hundreds of patients who ingested medical aid in dying, and many hundreds more who did not. Something I typically hear, I heard this many times from patients, is, I've just had it. I'm done. I don't want to keep doing this, whatever it is. So that's something I think that's kind of crucial to know, is that the doctor's evaluating the legal criteria, providing counseling, but it doesn't end there. They're going to continue to have conversation. Even though suffering is not a requirement, it is part of the discussion.
How do patients find a physician? Is this something that they can ask their physician? I mean, if I know that I've been diagnosed with cancer and this is something that I want as an option, not that it's going to be the choice that I'm going to make, but I want this to be on the table. Is it to my benefit to check out whether or not my physician is someone who supports it?
So my advice is, you know, you should be putting your feelers out early, because it is not easy to locate physicians. And I think the other part of the puzzle that's kind of complicated is that physicians are not required to refer you to another physician if they don't provide medical aid in dying. It's not a requirement in the law. So there's a couple of resources. One is the Academy of Aid in Dying Medicine. We have a patient to doctor referral system. We have an intake form. It's pretty bossy, but on purpose, because we don't share directly the doctor information online publicly, because physicians want to be careful. They don't want to known necessarily in the community. So we usually then take the intake form and forward it. So there are three sources of referrals. One is health systems. So there are health systems in California that allow their providers to act as attending providers. But in your area, it may be particularly hard to locate that. The other source is there are hospices that provide fully integrated aid in dying care, meaning their physicians can act as attendings. And then the last source are independent private providers, and they generally are, they provide very attentive care, but it's on a fee-for-service basis. Many of them will slide their scales, but those are the three main sources in California. We have seen things change over 10 years. Initially, hospices really, really siloed this care, and they were like, we're not going to allow our providers to act as attendings. But even on the Central Coast, there's one hospice that we know of where they are permitting their physicians to act as attending. But across California, that has been expanding in the past, I'm going to say, 5 years. We've seen more and more hospices that can see that when the care is integrated, those patients have more peaceful deaths, no matter how they die. Meaning a lot of patients are going to want to become eligible, but then all the way along the path, they may find that their dying process is actually quite acceptable. And I would add into this puzzle, you know about this, Chris, end-of-life doulas play a crucial role in your area, I think, because navigating and finding and stitching the whole puzzle together, that is really the expertise of doulas.
Talk a little bit about some of the myths about the medication itself, the idea that it's a pill that you take, and whether or not that holds true.
I have this funny graphic that's like a magic pill with a big red line through it. It is not a magic pill. It is true that years ago, it used to be 80 capsules of a phenobarbital that people would open into a cocktail glass, typically. But those times have changed. What we found is that initially when the laws passed in Oregon, the population that had legal access was very small. Well, the population in the United States that now has legal access is like 32% of the population. 1 in 3 Americans has legal access. So over time, the Academy gathered data. And when I say gather data, every data point is a death. Every single one is a death story. And we not only look at it with, you know, our data glasses on, but also with our human eyeballs in our heads. And you know, there's a tremendous amount of respect when we are given a death report. Like Dr. Lonnie Shavelson, who is our fearless leader in the Academy of Aid and Dying Medicine and long, long time man in the field, and my partner in crime and life, has been in this for a long, long time. And he reads pretty much every report that comes through. So what he found over time with his team, he crunched the numbers about the cocktail. And over time, that cocktail has changed. So what we found early in, like 10 years ago, was that while most patients who took medical aid and dying died within 2 hours, some of them took 2, 3, 4 days to die. So there was a need to shift the gears. And also, some of those medications literally are not available anymore. So the costs skyrocketed, it became unavailable. So the medications have changed, the cocktail has changed. It is now 3 huge doses of sedative medication and 2 cardiotoxins. And the goal is first to get the patient really comfortably asleep and comatose, and then slow their breathing and stop their heart. So that's the process that the medications have to do to work. And I think the myth is that it's easy to do. It's actually surprisingly hard. And over time, after gathering data, the cocktail has changed. But the big thing that has really changed is that I think we now understand that you need to not only get the medications into the body, but they also need to be absorbed by a functional GI tract. They need to meet receptors in the brain. They need to, you know, affect your organs. And that requires care. That requires more than just a pill you take when you're ready. It's powders that get mixed into 2 ounces of medication. And your team are following to be sure those medications are going to get absorbed and be used by your body in a functional way. So I think the myth is also that it's easy. The medications taste really awful. That is just part of the puzzle. And so over time, one of the things we've gathered data about is using a popsicle or low-fat sorbet, to cool the tongue before and after patients ingest the medication, because the goal is comfort, right? And patients generally drift into a pretty comfortable sleep within 5 to 10 minutes. And over time, as the medications and the cocktail have changed, we've been able to draw in those outliers so that patients are really, you know, dying within a reasonable amount of time. Their family, the other thing that we found is that having an experienced provider, a doula, a volunteer, someone at the bedside to help prepare the meds and to be there with the family is another crucial piece of the puzzle.
Do families often take care of this themselves rather than having someone experienced there?
I think the myth is that it's because it looks so easy that families should be able to do this on their own. What the Academy has found over time is that families who do this entirely on their own are often left with some trauma. So dying really ideally requires attentive care, and having an experienced clinician prepare the meds, it's not hard to do, but it is really dangerous. And having an experienced clinician, a doula, a volunteer, as I said, a hospice nurse, somebody prepare those meds and present them to the patient to self-ingest. Because again, no one can help the patient ingest the meds. They have to do that themselves.
But that's someone part else, of the law, right?
Yeah. In the law, it actually says that anyone can prepare the meds for the patient. So after that, presenting the meds to the patient, allowing the patient to ingest. So families were doing this entirely on their own, because I think initially, politically, it was easier to spin like, this is easy to do. Anyone can do it. So we should pass this law. And that was important. But after the laws passed, the clinical practices needed to change. So I think we found over time that it is best practice is to have an experienced person at your bedside.
When you talk about people having the choice and then making a decision that they want to have the option of a medical aid in dying, they may get the medication and then hang on to the medication. What have you found about that practice, and how is that now changed?
That's a very important question. So for me as a nurse, it's safety first. What we have found is that because patients, you know, they're going to spend some time uncertain, they're not going to necessarily have their plan in place. Patients who have their medications delivered too early run several risks. One is those medications are really dangerous to have hanging around your house.
Right.
And they're expensive. If you don't have that medication filled by the pharmacy, you're not charged the $700 that you would be. And giving your family time. So if you're going to make a plan for medical aid in dying, or someone in your family is, the best practice is to let the medication stay safely at the pharmacy. They've been prescribed. They just haven't been filled. And they can stay safely in the pharmacy, not in your house. I mean, it's a very lethal set of medications. And it also gives your family time. If you say, well, okay, now I'm really ready. I'm ready to really make a plan. And I, you know, it's usually we say within a week, okay, about a week before the medications can be delivered. Then your family can gather and it gives them a moment to kind of adjust and adapt because you're finally really deciding. We used to hear from patients all the time, oh, I want it right by my bedside in case I want to take it right away. Well, that leads to, you know, first of all, having the very dangerous medications in your house, but also maybe rash decision. So allowing your team, like if I am thinking about medical aid in dying and I'm having terrible pain, that is a call to my hospice team. I'm having terrible pain. It's not necessarily for me to grab straight for my medical aid in dying and to go. So, you know, it allows a little bit of a buffer of safety, which I think is kind of crucial. What we did for some patients is that we took a pill bottle and we put our phone number in the pill bottle. And we said, you just call us and we can have those medications. Typically, these medications can be delivered within, you know, 24 to 72 hours is not atypical. So,
okay, thank you. We're going to take a break and be right back. Over to you, Brad.
You can provide lasting annual support to KCBX through an endowment gift. One example is the Burt Bender and Judith Darknall Endowment, which reflects their commitment to public radio's mission and their belief that independent, thoughtful journalism fosters understanding and connection. If you'd like to help secure the future of KCBX, visit kcbxlegacy.org or call 805-549-8855.
You're listening to Central Coast Voices. Let's return to Chris Kington Barker and her guest. Back to you, Chris.
Welcome back. Today's show is a discussion about an Life Option Act passed in 2016, giving adults 18 or older the option to request aid in dying medication if they've been diagnosed as terminally ill with an expectation of 6 months or less to live by a minimum of two physicians. My guest is Thalia DeWolf, RN, CHPN, Nursing Education and Hospice Outreach Coordinator for the Academy of Aid and Dying Medicine. And welcome back, Thalia. So you were talking about some of the effects of the medication. One of the things that I think the Academy found as they gained more experience was also that how people were ready for the receiving of the medication, how their bodies were fit, what they had eaten beforehand, how they could eat. Can you talk a little bit about that? Because when you talk about this as being medical patients who were being cared for, and this is part of their practice, they weren't just given a prescription and then physicians hands off and they go about taking the medication whenever, right?
I think the planning phase of medical aid in dying is more complicated than we originally thought. So The Academy of Aid in Dying Medicine has found over time that the really crucial piece of the puzzle isn't just getting the meds into the body. It's also being sure that your GI tract is really absorptive. So crucial, I mean, we're famous in hospice, nurses are famous for the poop status, being sure that patients are not constipated. And in order to keep your GI tract really absorptive, you have to have a small amount of intake, even if it's just a teaspoon to a tablespoon of yogurt or ice cream a couple of times a day. It feeds the GI tract and it keeps it moving along, which is really crucial. So, you know, that's in the days leading up to medical aid in dying, is being sure that a patient is having some intake of any kind, but ideally with a little bit of protein. And, you know, it can be ice cream, which most people love, me included. Yeah. So it can be a little bit of yogurt, and that can be through a G-tube or orally. And then, you know, the night before medical aid in dying, nothing by mouth except for clear liquid. So I tell patients they can have coffee in the morning time if they want it. And the other thing that we found is that the medications really bond to fats. So nothing with any fat from sundown to the next day. And on the day of death, we recommend that patients, you know, don't have anything with any fat in it, but they can have clear liquids. That's what we call clear liquids. And that is one of the reasons that we recommend, you know, using a fat-free popsicle or, my favorite, some kind of sorbet, a spoonful of something sweet that's has no fat in it, but that's nice and cold just before a patient ingests and just after can make that really bitter taste and the burning sensation kind of fade.
And it's necessary if the patient is taking something by mouth that they be able to swallow the entire amount of the liquid, correct? So there is also a practice phase that is useful.
Crucial, absolutely crucial. And this is one of the reasons that we say like having a good hospice team is crucial. So practicing swallowing, it's only 2 ounces of medication, but when patients practice swallowing 2 ounces and it, you know, I've never seen a patient take the full 2 minutes to swallow the 2 ounces. Years ago, it used to be 4 ounces, which was a little harder to do. Now it's just 2 ounces, but practicing, it makes the patients feel less anxious on the day that they have to, that they want to proceed. So practicing, I think, is crucial. And if patients have difficulty with swallowing, that can sometimes, you know, throw a wrench into the work. So having a hospice nurse on your team that is assessing your GI tract and your ability to swallow, being sure that you can't take medical aid in dying if you've got nausea and vomiting. Like, it's not an option because you will throw those medications up. So being sure that your nausea and vomiting is well controlled, that your GI tract, any constipation is controlled, and also assessing your swallowing. If leading up to medical aid in dying, your nurse notices that you're having more and more difficulty with swallowing, they may point it out to you. That's about informed consent. So having nursing, you know, or a doula or a social worker be on board to kind of alert you, hey, there is a window of opportunity for medical aid in dying. It opens once a patient is eligible, and it closes once the patient doesn't have capacity anymore and it isn't going to return, or once they've really lost the ability to ingest safely. It's what I call a safe death. It's kind of a weird thing to say, but there is something called a safe death. And sometimes medical aid in dying is not the most safe or the most peaceful way to proceed in certain circumstances, which is why you really want hospice on board.
Some people are still calling this physician-assisted suicide. How is it that that is the wrong terminology and why?
So patients who are eligible for medical aid in dying are not choosing between living and dying. They're choosing their mechanism of dying. They're already in the process of dying. Most patients who want medical aid in dying don't want to cut their life short, but they may want to cut their dying short.
That's a big difference.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. For the families of people who have chosen this option, how can they get prepared for this? Are there ways that they can become more familiar, more comfortable, find answers to questions, reach out for some support?
So that this is a really important piece of the puzzle. I think the best way to reduce anxiety is to have things be predictable. So for patients to really know, and their families to really know what to expect from medical aid in dying, what it is, what it isn't. For one, you can always go to our website, but the other piece of the puzzle is there is nothing better than having a really experienced clinician, which could be a doula, could be a volunteer. I just think that that's a crucial piece of the puzzle. And I think the other thing that's really tricky is that medical aid in dying, it is still dying. It is, you know, let us not sugarcoat that it is a process of dying. It's not necessarily easy. You know, I think that we've increasingly found that while families of patients who ingested medical aid in dying and died aren't any more prone to complex grief than other kinds of families, they still sometimes require very special grief counseling. They don't necessarily, a family member doesn't necessarily want to go to a group and be the voice of medical aid in dying. They just want to talk about the fact that their loved one is now dead and gone. So having specialized grief care, I think, is really crucial. And there is a part of grief care that's what we call anticipatory death, anticipatory grief, rather. And anticipatory grief is the notion that you're getting ready to lose the person that you love and that they're going to be gone, it's a very jagged part of grief. And I think reaching out to hospices and, you know, experienced clinicians for support is crucial.
Has the Academy found that those patients who are on hospice at the time that they ingest, they and the families do better, are more strongly supported than those who have not chosen to be on a hospice?
I have to say, at this point in the United States, the vast majority of patients who ingest or become eligible for medical aid in dying are in hospice at the time of their death, whether they take the medications to die or not. So I think that what's crucial about this is that we don't really, there's not another cohort that we can compare. So we don't have solid data, but we do have anecdotal data that shows that patients, families that are well supported and not required to do this on their own do better. It's less complicated. We've got many cases where families really did this on their own and things didn't go as well as I think they could have if they'd had, you know, an experienced clinician at the bedside. But every hospice in states where medical aid in dying is legal will eventually have a patient that either comes in with their prescription already in hand or employs an independent provider. So every hospice is eventually going to care for these patients. And in a perfect world, those hospices need to have their teams really prepared to provide that care. But I know it's a tall order, but quite doable. We are training hospices across the United States.
What you mentioned that for those folks that have just said, I'm done, you know, that is a big reason for choosing medical aid in dying. What is another factor for people that choose, that say, I want this as an option? What is it? What is the driver of that?
There's some interesting statistics that we've uncovered at the Academy. And one is, while cancer is a huge portion of the patients that consider or ingest medical aid in dying, mm-hmm. Interesting. If you look at the neurological diseases, especially ALS, they proportionately have a much higher rate in the uptake of medical aid in dying. And we suspect the reason why is that ALS is just such an unrelenting disease process.
Yeah.
And so that's, you know, one component. I don't really know that we can dive much further into why patients do or don't proceed. I think a lot of patients simply proceed because it's an expression of their autonomy. They want control of their end of life.
And you've mentioned that there are a number of people who do not, even though they have the medication, they don't utilize it.
The statistics have been skewed because since the Academy came into existence in 2020, the best practice has been to not deliver the medications until the patient really has a solid plan. And we've also normalized the idea of that changing plan. That's just like a normal part of the process. So now the statistics are showing that it's a much higher rate of patients considering and completing. But the truth is, we don't know, because mm-hmm. the best practices have shifted, I am happy to say. And, you know, it's a confounding factor.
And what are some of the differences? What creates some of the elongation for people just naturally who have longer times from ingestion to death? You know, it's not the same for everyone. What are things that, because it could be alarming for families who think this is going to be a half hour, they go to sleep, 2 hours, they've taken their last breath, and that doesn't happen.
Yeah, it does happen. So we at the Academy have developed factors for prolonged death that clinicians can look at. We also have a clinician hotline. So typically when we get a data point that shows a really long time to death, which for us is, you know, anything over 5 hours is long, and anything over, you know, 12, we have various points that we look at. And typically what we see, if you look we do a postmortem look back. It's usually something to do either with the GI tract. So patients don't have an absorptive GI tract. They've had nothing by mouth for months, or maybe they've got an abdomen filled up with a lot of fluid and it's pressing on their GI tract. The other component that's really important is patients who have a very high tolerance to various medications like opioids that are in the cocktail. And we do have recommendations for changing the prescription. This is one of the crucial pieces of the puzzle. When an attending provider is evaluating, they're writing a prescription, but that's not the end of the process. So as patients progress to their end of life, they change. So their GI tract changes, their taking of comfort medications may change. So if there's a feedback loop back to that provider may say, oh, this patient is now taking a lot of comfort meds and we don't want them to stop. We want them to be comfortable, but now I'm going to increase the meds. So we have something called a high dose medication regime that people can read about and that clinicians can call us and ask us. So that is another crucial piece of the puzzle is that the prescription might change. The route might change. If the patient has difficulty swallowing, that provider might say, hey, let's go ahead and do the rectal route, which I know when you say rectal route, it's kind of a scary thing to hear, but I have to tell you, the catheter is very, very thin. It only goes about 2 inches into the rectum, and it's about half what a typical enema is. It's only 2 ounces. It's a very graceful way to die. I had one patient who was fully dressed in a tuxedo and sitting upright, and he depressed his plunger and had a peaceful death. So,
what do you take away from the different deaths that you've experienced? Is there some kind of a common thing that you walk away with that leaves you with, you know, continuing to do this, continuing to support medical aid in dying, continuing to wanna improve the process? What is it that drives you in this?
You know, when I initially, my very, very first patient was our first patient in our hospice. And when medical aid in dying became legal in the state of California, I thought it was just going to be another way that people die, just one other way. I didn't think it was going to be a huge deal. And I worked in a very sweet hospice, but it was Catholic owned. So we were fully opted out. And basically, our team came together and we did have a discussion and our leaders were super sweet, but they basically told us what we were not allowed to do. They didn't tell us what we could do. And it was really kind of scary and confusing. We were not to really discuss it. If we needed to, we were supposed to refer the patient to our medical director. We were not to, you know, touch the meds or talk about the meds. We weren't supposed to be in the room. We weren't supposed to be in the house. It was very confusing. So I think what drives me, I had our very first patient. This patient secretly found Dr. Lonnie Shavelson, and I watched him care for this patient, and I saw that death be handled. He walked her all the way through the process. This patient was, you know, she had a neurological disease. She was like, as soon as somebody has to wipe my butt, I'll be done. And you know what? Over time, I put her in a brief. I gave her a Foley catheter. We handled it. And we continued to talk with Lonnie Shavelson. He just said, you know, when you're ready, we might proceed with this. But in the interim, I'm just going to keep following you. Keep talking to me. And so what I found over time was that really caring for these patients the way we would care for any dying patient to be sure that they had a peaceful end of life was that's just my driving passion is to make sure that patients get good care no matter how they die. So improving access, improving care, gathering data, developing best practices, it's just my passion.
When we first started supporting medical aid in dying here on the Central Coast, I know that for the physicians, the very few that were supportive, there really was no recipe. There was nothing really written. It was try to figure it out. And the things that the Academy is talking about, the idea of kind of diet restrictions for a person or educating patients ahead of time, being able to have conversations following the patient, having the physician extend the patient's care so that they're continuing to talk with the patient and see the patient. They were really just prescribing and then not seeing the patient again or ever intending to. That practice has really gone so far beyond that. And I'm assuming it's one of the reasons that the Academy changed the name from medical aid in dying to aid in dying medicine, because it really is the practice of medicine for people who are choosing aid in dying.
Yeah, I think that, you know, there was a lot that we learned, and new states that have come on, New York, Delaware, and Illinois, are benefiting from our 10 years of experience. So I'm very proud to be part of the Academy. We now have a Journal of Aid in Dying Medicine with evidence-based practices getting publication. It's not easy for us to have a lot of data because we can't have controlled studies, but I think clinicians, the first time we had a conference, people met in the hallway in 2020 and just burst into tears and hugged each other. We wanted to talk about. We needed each other. And I think the Academy has made a really safe space for clinicians who are facing these patients to come together and talk about it. I think many of us have been worried, been frightened all the way along the path for our employment safety and having a safe place to kind of talk about best practices. And again, like, we develop best practices. We know they're aspirational. Not every health institution is going to be able to achieve that. But I think knowing that there are best practices and that they're evidence-based, it kind of gives it just gives a reality check that I think is crucial.
Where do you think the access for other people, because you mentioned it is an access problem. If people need to pay $700 for the medication, that's a given. People pay $700 for the medication. And if they don't have it, it's possible that families can help with that. I even had one gentleman tell me, well, I put it on my credit card, come and get me, you know?
Totally.
It's just like, okay, they're going to do what they're going to do. Insurances may or may not pay for the physician. What do they pay for the physician who's practicing aid in dying medicine?
So in various health systems, the end-of-life conversation, it's wrapped up into an end-of-life conversation, and it's billable in as an end-of-life planning discussion. So there are large healthcare organizations that are able to provide. But then after that, after they write the prescription, the patient goes into hospice. And, you know, I think it's a challenge for them to not just silo that for fear that they're going to lose their funding from CMS. The other way that patients manage this is to hire an independent provider. And, you know, there are some patients who just don't want to work on a sliding scale. So that can be thousands of dollars, very typically. The care is very typically very attentive. But on the Central Coast, there's just not a lot of providers. It's hard.
Mm-hmm. I will say that the ACA MAID mm-hmm. website is free with yeah. information that people can go to and look at how can I find a physician? How can I get information about this? One of the things that we didn't touch on is if someone got their medication, they don't have to use it. They don't have to take the prescription. And all the way up to the day of, they're asked over and over again, do you want to make this choice? Mm-hmm. Even sure? when the medication is mixed, it's you still have an out. So there is nothing that weds people to a choice right up until the end.
Yeah, crucially, in the law is that the patient has the right to never ingest the medication. They have the right to refuse. I mean, I would say refuse, but it's not an accurate term. It's really, they have a right to make it. To just decide. And actually, when I was caring for patients at the bedside, I can remember coming to the door and saying to the patient, or being in the living room and saying, you know, you can send me away. And he said, you know, I want one more day at the beach. And I was like, great, this is going to be great. And I actually myself went and had one more day at the beach. So at any point, up to the point where the patient ingests the medication, they don't have to make that choice. It's just having the option.
Yeah. Anything in a minute that you want to say that we didn't get to today?
Boy, I don't
You're know. Thinking.
No, just, you know, don't hesitate to reach out to the Academy of Aid and Dying Medicine. Our website is free, of course. It's aadm.org. And we have a patient information page that has a lot of information. And we also have a page for planning and preparing that I think can help patients and families understand what to expect out of medical aid in dying.
Thank you. I want to thank my guests for today, Thalia DeWolf, RN, CHPN, Nursing Education and Hospice Outreach Coordinator for the Academy of Aid in Dying Medicine. More information about today's discussion also available at endoflifechoicesca.org if you want to have some information about medical aid in dying. I'm Chris Kington Barker for you on Central Coast Voices. Thank you for joining me today and for being a KCBX listener.